Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Coming to you today with 10, maybe 15% less nasal congestion than yesterday. Woohoo! Still not 100%, but feeling a bit better. Hey, we're up to Book 6, Chapter 24, XXIV. No betrothal ceremony took place, and Natasha's engagement to Bolkonski was not announced. Prince Andrew insisted on that. He said that, as he was responsible for the delay, he ought to bear the whole burden of it, that he had given his word and bound himself forever, but that he did not wish to bind Natasha, and gave her perfect freedom. If, after 6 months, she felt that she did not love him, she would have full right to reject him. Naturally, either Natasha nor her parents wished to hear of this, but Prince Andrew was firm. He came every day to the Rostovs, but did not behave to Natasha as an affianced lover. He did not use the familiar thou, but said you to her, and kissed only her hand. After their engagement, quite different, intimate and natural relations sprang up between them. It was as if they had not known each other until now. Both liked to recall how they had regarded each other when, as yet, they were nothing to one another. They felt themselves now quite different beings. Then they were artificial, now natural and sincere. At first the family felt some constraint in intercourse with Prince Andrew. He seemed a man from another world, and for a long time Natasha trained the family to get used to him, proudly assuring them all that he had only appeared to be different, but was really just like all of them, and that she was not afraid of him, and no one else ought to be. After a few days they grew accustomed to him, and without restraint in his presence pursued their usual way of life, in which he took his part. He could talk about rural economy with the Count, fashions with the Countess and Natasha, and about albums and fancy work with Sonia. Sometimes the household, both among themselves and in his presence, expressed their wonder at how it had all happened, and at the evident omens there had been of it, Prince Andrew's coming to Otradnoe, and their coming to Petersburg, and the likeness between Natasha and Prince Andrew which her nurse had noticed on his first visit, and Andrew's encounter with Nicholas in 1805, and many other incidents betokening that it had to be. In the house, that poetic dullness and quiet reigned which always accompanies the presence of a betrothed couple. Often, when all sitting together, everyone kept silent. Sometimes the others would get up and go away, and the couple, left alone, still remained silent. They rarely spoke of their future life. Prince Andrew was afraid and ashamed to speak of it. Natasha shared this, as she did all his feelings, which she constantly divined. Once she began questioning him about his son. Prince Andrew blushed, as he often did now. Natasha particularly liked it in him, and said that his son would not live with them. "Why not?" asked Natasha in a frightened tone. "I cannot take him away from his grandfather, and besides..." "How should I have loved him?" said Natasha, immediately guessing his thought. "But I know you wish to avoid any pretext for finding fault with us." Sometimes the old Count would come up, kiss Prince Andrew, and ask his advice about Petya's education or Nicholas's service. The old Countess sighed as she looked at them. Sonia was always getting frightened lest she should be in the way, and tried to find excuses for leaving them alone, even when they did not wish it. When Prince Andrew spoke, he could tell a story very well. Natasha listened to him with pride. When she spoke, she noticed with fear and joy that he gazed attentively and scrutinizingly at her. She asked herself in perplexity, "What does he look for in me? He is trying to discover something by looking at me. What if what he seeks is in me is not there?" Sometimes she fell into one of the mad, merry moods characteristic of her, and then she particularly loved to hear and see how Prince Andrew laughed. He seldom laughed. But when he did, he abandoned himself entirely to his laughter, and after such a laugh she always felt nearer to him. Natasha would have been completely happy if the thought of the separation awaiting her and drawing near had not terrified her, just as the mere thought of it made him turn pale and cold. On the eve of his departure from Petersburg, Prince Andrew brought with him Pierre, who had not been to the Rostovs once since the ball. Pierre seemed disconcerted and embarrassed. He was talking to the Countess, and Natasha sat down beside a little chess table with Sonya, thereby inviting Prince Andrew to come too. He did so. "You have known Bezukhov a long time," he asked. "Do you like him?" "Yes, he's a dear, but very absurd." And as usual when speaking of Pierre, she began to tell anecdotes of his absent-mindedness, some of which had even been invented about him. "Do you know I have entrusted him with our secret? I have known him from childhood. He has a heart of gold. I beg you, Natalie," Prince Andrew said with sudden seriousness. "I am going away, and heaven knows what may happen. You may cease to..." "All right. I know I am not to say that. Only this, then. Whatever may happen to you when I am not there, what can happen?" "Whatever trouble may come," Prince Andrew continued, "I beg you, Mademoiselle Sophie, whatever may happen, to turn to him alone for advice and help. He is a most absent-minded and absurd fellow, but he has a heart of gold." Neither her father, nor her mother, nor Sonya, nor Prince Andrew himself could have foreseen how the separation from her lover would act on Natasha. Flushed and agitated, she went about the house all that day, dry-eyed, occupied with most trivial matters, as if not understanding what awaited her. She did not even cry when, on taking leave, he kissed her hand for the last time. "Don't go," she said in a tone that made him wonder whether he really ought not to stay, and which he remembered long afterwards. Nor did she cry when he was gone, but for several days she sat in her room, dry-eyed, taking no interest in anything, and only saying now and then, "Oh, why did he go away?" But a fortnight later, after his departure, to the surprise of those around her, she recovered from her mental sickness just as suddenly and became her old self again, but with a change in her moral physiognomy, as a child gets up after a long illness with a changed expression of face. All right, there we have it, another chapter down. And it looks like Prince Andrei is going to honour his father's request for a one-year-long engagement, even though the request doesn't really serve Prince Andrei in any way, or Natasha. It seemed like a rather selfish request. Old man Bolkonski pretty much just didn't really agree with the wedding, and kind of thought, "I'll probably be dead within a year anyway, so just don't do it in the next year and I'm fine." As far as I could tell, that was the reasons before it. Now, previously, I kind of thought, yeah, they're going to go for it. They're going to, you know, he said he'll do it. But, you know, they probably won't. Or at the very least, maybe they won't get married for a year, but they'll probably just, you know, live together for the year and be like a normal engaged couple. Like, in modern times, if you're engaged, you're pretty much married for all intents and purposes, other than the legal part of it, that you live together and you cohabitate, and there's not much difference between an engaged couple and a married couple when you look at their day-to-day lives. But now I'm starting to see that in this case he's actually going to put some distance between them, and I think what we saw in this chapter was him saying that he's not going to see her for the whole year. I think, I'm not entirely sure, I might have that wrong, but that seemed to be the case. And he's saying that he's going to be loyal and do all the things a fiancé should do or a husband should do, but that she doesn't have to pay back the same courtesy. Essentially, he's saying, like, if you find someone better or you want to entertain, you know, some flirtations with someone else, that's fine, go ahead. Weird little arrangement they've got going on there. Reddit user Garrock asked the question, "Andre trusts Pierre to steer any concerns of Natasha's in Andre's absence," referring to his heart of gold often. "Do you think Andre missed Pierre's bitterness towards his happiness? Do you think Andre is correct in trusting Pierre's motivations and mood?" Caucus Tree said, "Where does it say Pierre associates his own depression with Andre's newfound romance?" To which Obi-Wan Spicoli responded. Now, I'm interested to read these responses because I kind of missed that as well. I never got any hint of Pierre being jealous or bitter towards Pierre. Towards Andre, sorry. Now, Obi-Wan Spicoli said, "There's a few instances where Andre's happiness brings out a little bit of bitterness in Pierre. For example, 2.3.21, page 470 for me. This is in a different version of the book, but it reads as follows. Something very important is going on between them, thought Pierre, and a joyful and at the same time bitter feeling stirred him and made him forget the game." Then, a few pages later, on 474, Pierre is already unhappy, but when Andre announces that he is in love, Pierre suddenly sighed deeply and dropped his heavy body onto the sofa beside Prince Andre. Obi-Wan Spicoli went on to say, "I think Prince Andre's happiness is a reminder of Pierre's own unhappiness. However, I think he has nothing but love for the prince." "Well, well, talk, I'm very glad," said Pierre, and indeed his face changed, the furrow smoothed out, and he listened joyfully to Prince Andre. "I think Pierre is able to be happy for his friend despite the situation he is in. Envious is not the right word, but Pierre certainly wishes he had met someone like Natasha and could be happy." I completely missed that reading those last few chapters, but now with those few examples, I can certainly see that Pierre is just kind of like rubbing it in his face a bit. He's unhappy in his marriage and he really isn't very pleased with his wife. And now he's got to see his best mate so giddy and excited about this new girl. And yeah, that must sting a little bit. Turtle Vader responded, adding to this, the last line of that bit says, "The brighter Prince Andre's fate seemed to him, the gloomier seemed his own." I think the discussion question is more than fair, and it's very interesting to consider that Pierre might not act with the purest intentions, but I suppose we'll have to wait and see. De Fleury made a good comment about the different translations, saying that, "I see you got the boring translation, dropped his heavy body, while I got dumped his heavy person," which is such a poetic description of the broken feeling of depression, showing his entire self, mind and soul, is heavy, not just his overweight body, and dump is literally what you do with dirt and garbage, and result in a mess. You can pick up something you dropped, but you have to shovel up something you dumped. New theory. Does one's sympathy for Pierre depend on which translation one is reading? That's a good question. We got the dumped his heavy person line, I'm pretty sure, which I actually thought was a really good line too, and dropped his heavy body. Sometimes with these other translations, I feel like they referred too much to previous translations, and it's almost like they translated from the translation, like they got a copy in English and then just looked for synonyms for all the words, because the fact that dropped his heavy body changed to dumped his heavy person. It's like they've just used the Microsoft Word synonyms function all throughout one of the already published English versions of the book. Sometimes I feel that way. Obi-Wan Spicoli responded, "I wonder what was in the original Russian text. Maybe someone could comment on it. Did Tolstoy intend the poetic version with psychological subtext of the boring, straightforward prose? I chose the P&V translation because Richard Purveyor made a convincing argument that his translation was as close to what Tolstoy intended as one could get in English." Here's a quote from Richard Purveyor. "Tolstoy's prose has been much praised and much criticized. He scorned fine writers, calling them hairdressers. Yet we know from the many drafts he preserved that he constantly worked over his texts, revising and refining them, bringing them closer to what he wanted to express. Tolstoy's prose is an artistic medium. It is all of a piece. It is not good or bad Russian prose. It is Tolstoyan prose. What the translator should seek in his own language is the equivalent of that specific artistic medium. He must have the freedom in his own language to be faithful to the original." Well, that's very interesting stuff indeed. We'd have to speak to someone like Brian E. Denton, who's read the book in many different translations. I think that would be a good idea. Get his opinion on which translations are the best. Anyway, this is going to be it for today, for another episode. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.